Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nigel Adderley, and in the early hours of Saturday the 30th of December, these are our main stories. On the day of Russia's heaviest aerial bombardment of Ukraine, President Zelensky appeals for more Western support.
This is yet another sign for our partners to strengthen Ukraine with the air defence we need to become the shield between the aggressor and Europe. We are capable of protecting us all. Just give us the means to do so.
The humanitarian crisis in Gaza deepens as tens of thousands more refugees flee the Israeli offensive.
We've been asking for help for 3 months. Nobody is listening to us. We are saying that again. Help us. That's enough.
President Milei continues his radical agenda in Argentina by pulling the country out of the BRICS group of nations. And NewsHour presenter Julian Marshall meets someone who sounds very familiar.
Hello, real Julian. I'm AI Julian. How are you today? I'm here to steal your job. Do you have any tips that could help me improve my presenting skills?
Ukraine has stressed the need for continued support from the West following a massive wave of Russian missile strikes that has left at least 30 people dead and caused huge material damage. It's the largest aerial assault on the country since Russia invaded in February last year. More than 150 drones and missiles were fired. Some were brought down by Ukraine's air defences, but many still got through. Schools, hospitals and residential areas were among those hit. Our first report is from our correspondent James Waterhouse in Kyiv.
It was a sunrise which brought three powerful explosions. One of the areas hit was a warehouse, which had been hollowed out from front to back. Nearby, glass had been blown off the entire side of a skyscraper. It's a level of devastation only caused by a direct missile strike. Maria lives nearby.
I was woken up at 7:30 by a horrible sound. It was so frightening. The missile was flying and everything was buzzing, so noisy. I didn't know what to do. I wanted to run down to the shelter. I thought of running into the bathroom, and as I went there, the mirror flew off the wall with such force that if it happened a moment earlier, I'd have cuts all over.
Kyiv could have been forgiven for thinking raids such as this had become a thing of the past with its improved air defences, but the breadth and scale of this attack means it's likely they were overwhelmed. Lviv in the west, Sumy in the north, Kharkiv in the northeast, Dnipro in the east, and Odessa in the south were all hit by hypersonic and ballistic missiles, as well as Iranian-made Shahed drones. As Kyiv's mayor Vitaly Klitschko points out, with the final approved US military package arriving this week, Ukraine's ability to keep defending itself is far from assured.
Russia have huge resources and we are limited. Please stay to support Ukraine and please never forget. We're defending right now not just our houses and our land. We're defending every one of you.
Ukraine's Air Force claimed it had never seen so many incoming missiles in a single attack. In a war where Moscow routinely strikes cities it can't occupy, that is saying something.
James Waterhouse in Kyiv. The US President Joe Biden has said the assault is renewed proof that President Putin must be stopped and has called on the US Congress to step up. It so far blocked sending around $60 billion to Ukraine. Britain announced on Friday it was sending around 200 air defence missiles to the country in response to what it called Russia's latest wave of murderous airstrikes. With the second anniversary of the war approaching, our correspondent Gordon Carrera has been looking at how tactics on both sides are developing.
It had been long feared that Russia had been stockpiling missiles for an air assault large enough to overcome Ukraine's anti-aircraft defences. But the real target of the strike was not so much the buildings that were hit, but Ukraine's morale. Neither side has managed a major breakthrough with its offensives on the ground in recent months, despite heavy losses. Russia has made some small gains recently, but a decisive shift seems unlikely, and so the challenge for each side now is trying to outlast the other and carry out operations which exact a psychological toll. Ukraine knows that it's faced with an adversary with more manpower and resources. It hopes that tactical successes, like the strike on a Russian Navy landing ship 3 days ago, can provide a sense that it is still able to inflict damage on Russia. That is vital to ensure it can mobilise domestic and wider international support. Moscow, meanwhile, will be hoping that the sheer scale of this wave of air attacks will be enough to shake Ukrainian resolve by making the population across the country question whether they can be protected.
Gordon Carrera. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says more than 300 people have been killed while taking refuge in UN shelters in Gaza since the war began. The UN humanitarian chief, Martin Griffiths, says the situation is not only impossible for people in Gaza, but for those trying to help them as well. His comments come as Israeli forces expand their offensive in the southern city of Khan Yunis, driving more Palestinians into Rafah, which is already overcrowded and is also being bombed. At least 20 people are said to have been killed there and dozens injured after an Israeli airstrike. This resident was there when Rafah was hit.
We were sleeping at home and we suddenly heard an explosion and the stones started falling. So I opened the window and I heard the neighbours calling for help. So we came and found out a two-floor building that was full with displaced people, women and children, collapsed on them. Nobody is listening to us. We are saying that again. Help us. That's enough.
Peace talks are continuing. Egypt and Qatar met a Hamas delegation in Cairo on Friday in a renewed effort to stop the fighting. But with the Israeli government saying their mission is at an essential stage and Hamas refusing to release their remaining hostages whilst under fire, any diplomatic solution seems some way off. We'll hear more about those talks in Egypt shortly. But first, I asked our correspondent in Jerusalem, Shaima Khalil, what the situation was like in Rafah.
Very bad. And remember, Rafah is extremely crucial. It's the southernmost part of Gaza. Again, extremely overcrowded because at the beginning of the conflict, many people went south to Khan Yunis and in Rafah. But also, this is the area bordering Egypt where the Rafah crossing and the Kerem Shalom crossings are. And this is normally where aid comes in. It's been very difficult because of the continued bombardment. A very, very small town. Thousands and thousands of people coming in. Not very much space. But as it becomes very densely populated, there is bombardment on that area at the moment.
And we have heard about the potential peace talks in Cairo. How much hope is there for those?
Each side is looking at this quite skeptically and with a great deal of mistrust. We haven't heard official responses from either, but I think Egypt is watching this very carefully, trying with this proposal to present it in three phases that would see the gradual release of hostages, that would see periods of pauses in the fighting that could lead to a ceasefire. They've also proposed this governing body of technocrats, of experts, to administer Gaza. But with these two sides so entrenched in their positions at the moment, it's a huge gap to try and bridge. But also, I think, if, and it's still a big if they agree in principle, it's going to be a long, drawn-out process to negotiate every single detail of that proposed agreement.
Shaima Khalil. In Israel, many of the survivors of the Hamas attacks of the 7th of October and released hostages have been trying to come to terms with their ordeals. Renuna Eitan is the head of psychiatry at the Ichilov Medical Center in Tel Aviv. She's been helping some of the released hostages and told Rebecca Kesby more about what they've been through.
Most of them were held in inhumane sanitary conditions, subject to starvation, to beating, sexual abuse. Some of them were held in solitary confinement. And we know that some also spent long times underground in total darkness until they developed severe hallucinations and other mental symptoms. They were forced to watch brutal videos, and this really can affect a child. They were under constant threat threats with weapons. And many of them, they are afraid, they cannot sleep during the night, they have nightmares. Some of them get into dissociative states. They feel that they're back in the captivity in Gaza.
You mentioned that some of the people you're treating are children, and also that people have been subject to sexual violence. Some of the children actually witnessed that too, didn't they?
Yes, I am a psychiatrist now over 20 years, and I've never seen such a deliberate and brutal abuse of children. Another problem is that some children and adolescents and also adults, they were given psychiatric drugs in order to control them. So the impact of going through a traumatic event under the influence of specific drugs, we actually don't know what it's going to be like. Let's say we have to rewrite the textbook now of trauma. Since October 7th, there is a huge increase in people that come over to the ER of the hospital, and we opened a specific clinic to treat the patients that come with post-traumatic symptoms. And we have seen hundreds of patients, people from southern Israel. They experience terrible traumatic events during October 7th. They have their own traumatic memories. And on top of that, now they hear what happened to those unfortunate hostages that were taken to Gaza.
And when you look at the scenes that we've seen coming out of Gaza too, and particularly for the children living in Gaza who have been displaced, witnessed awful things, the destruction, the death of family members, what would be your concerns about what their trauma might be like in the future?
I'm sure that like the whole generation here in Israel, living both in Gaza and all over Israel, they're all going to have severe post-traumatic symptoms. As health providers will have to take the responsibility. It's going to take years. It's not on during the first year. Usually the second year is the worst.
Renuna Eitan speaking to Rebecca Kesby. Two major aid organizations have paused their operations in Sudan's embattled El Ghazira state because of looting. The state capital fell to the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces this month. Will Leonardo reports.
As Sudan's devastating civil war grinds on, aid agencies say looting is making it hard to operate in areas that need them the most. The UN's World Food Programme said its warehouse in El Jazeera with supplies to feed 1.5 million people was targeted. A WFP official said Sudanese civilians had been robbed of critical assistance. The medical charity MSF said armed men had attacked its compound in the state capital Wad Madani, taking cars and other items. Its staff are now being evacuated to safer areas. The city had become a refuge for civilians fleeing from other contested areas of Sudan. Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced by the RSF offensive, many for a second time.
Will Leonardo. 2 days before Argentina were due to join the BRICS group of nations, they pulled out. The new president, Javier Milei, sent a letter to the leaders of Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa, going back on the plans of his left-wing predecessor. The BRICS grouping is often seen as a counterweight to the G7, which includes the US, Japan and Germany. I spoke to Facundo Iglesias, a journalist in Argentina.
The new government's announcement that they are leaving should come as no surprise. Milei has said that his government would pursue closer relations with the United States, Israel, and what he calls the free world. Then in November, after Milei won the presidential runoff, his foreign secretary announced that Argentina would not be joining the BRICS. As for the specific reasons, they seem to be purely ideological. Not even far-right President Jair Bolsonaro withdrew from the BRICS. Milei has been calling both China and Brazil, two of the most important countries in the BRICS, communist countries. In today's letter, he just said many aspects of the current foreign policy differ from those of the previous administration, giving no further reason. But what media pundits, both left-wing and right-wing, have said is that this has purely ideological motivations.
Of course, he's only recently come into office. He has a very radical agenda. How will this help his agenda?
He hasn't conceded in what he has promised. So showing him a pure ally of the United States could, in his view, advance the negotiations with the International Monetary Fund, which is, of course, led by the United States.
People in Argentina have withstood financial issues for many, many years. What has been the reaction of the people in Argentina to what's happened since he became the president.
There is a sector that is protesting against mainly the austerity measures. Inflation, of course, has been historically high here in Argentina, but this latest devaluation has even pushed prices up from what they were before. Just to give you an example, beef, which is something that Argentines love, has gone up by 50% just since the beginning of December. That has never happened like that high. I mean, we are used to inflation, but that's high even for us. So there were protests that they are far from being massive protests. People that from poor neighborhoods massively voted for Milei, and I asked them, these austerity measures, will they be an impact on you? And they are ready for that, right? They say, of course, these austerity measures will not be beneficial for me in the short term, but I know that in the long term they will be. So I am ready.
Facundo Iglesias in Argentina. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
Well, we've got a really good understanding of a very small part of the moon, and that's the near side, the bit that we see all the time. So we don't know hardly anything at all about the far side.
We hear about what 2024 and beyond holds for space exploration. The authorities in Ethiopia's Tigray region say it's on the verge of a humanitarian catastrophe, comparable to the famine in the 1980s, which prompted the Live Aid concert. Tigray's interim administration, which was established following a two-year civil war, said a dark cloud of starvation and death was hovering over the region. It said more than 90% of the population was at risk. Our Africa regional editor is Richard Hamilton.
Really interesting historical comparison. That famine in 1983 to 1985 was created by a perfect storm of adverse events. There was a recurring drought, failed harvest, a conflict that prevented aid from getting in, and government policies that relocated families and routed relief to certain areas. And there's this famous report in 1984 by the BBC's Michael Burke, who called it a biblical famine now in the 20th century. I remember seeing that report, and someone else who saw it was the Irish singer Bob Geldof, who of course created Band Aid and the Live Aid concert and raised millions for aid relief. And that concert was in July 1985. And now it looks as if we're seeing a similar interplay of environmental factors and human cruelty. The Indian economist Amartya Sen said famines are not a natural disaster, but a result of social and political factors where vulnerable groups lose entitlement to food. So he's basically saying famines are not acts of God, but acts of man. And it seems that this time we've had a two-year civil war in Tigray. There was astonishing destruction by the Ethiopian federal government forces. They destroyed hospitals, infrastructure. They brought Tigray to its knees. More than 1 million people were forcibly displaced. Hundreds of thousands are killed, and they prevented aid getting in. This is a devastating situation, and we're seeing history repeat itself.
But Ethiopia's federal authorities have denied there's a famine. So why have they done that?
They have said that it's a drought, that it's not yet a famine. That may be a technical point. They may be right on that. They say they're helping people with the drought. But critics say they don't want the world to see what they have done. The war was conducted in secrecy. The internet, the phones were cut off. They were accused, the federal government, of using starvation as a weapon of war. They stopped aid from getting in. And they don't want to draw attention, allegedly, to these man-made factors. So the interim authority, which has taken over the region, says the Ethiopian government have done their part to silence the guns. Now they should do their part to address this looming humanitarian catastrophe.
Richard Hamilton. Police in India say they're trying to identify the suspected human traffickers who attempted to send more than 300 Indians illegally to the US via Mexico. The plane had been chartered to fly from Dubai to Nicaragua, but was halted in France last week whilst refuelling. Our South Asia correspondent Ambarisa Natarajan reports from Delhi.
French officials detained the plane and the passengers after receiving an anonymous tip-off. After 4 days of investigation, the French authorities allowed most of the passengers to return to India, while 24 of them sought asylum in France. Indian police said the migrants had been promised safe passage to the US and had paid up to $150,000 per person. Nicaragua is seen as one of the staging points for illegal migrants to enter the US through Mexico. Most of the passengers were from the states of Gujarat and Punjab. Data from the US Customs and Border Protection last month showed that an unprecedented number of Indian immigrants were crossing into the United States on foot through its southern and northern borders. Figures showed nearly 97,000 Indians were apprehended, expelled, or denied entry after having entered the US without papers since October 2022.
I'm Barrison Etarajan. This year saw some big developments in space exploration. Elon Musk's much-anticipated Starship spacecraft launch, containing the most powerful rocket ever built, exploded not once, but twice in trying. But his company, SpaceX, remains undeterred in their mission to champion a fully reusable transport system capable of carrying up to 100 people to the Red Planet. In complete contrast, India made history when Chandrayaan 3 became the first mission to touch down at the lunar South Pole. So, what discoveries in space exploration can we look forward to in 2024? Leda Nathu spoke to Monica Grady, Professor of Planetary and Space Sciences at the Open University here in England.
Next year, there's going to be two sets of exciting targets. One is our moon, which is going to be targeted by NASA and the European Space Agency and the Chinese Space Agency. And then also Mars's moon, Phobos, is going to be explored by the Japanese Space Agency.
So starting with our moon, what do we still need to find out about the moon? What's the kind of specific aim of these missions?
So there's a big international program called Artemis, a series of short missions which are setting up the technology to eventually land astronauts back on the moon. There's a mission which is going towards the end of 2024, and this will just orbit the moon. And then sometime in 2025, astronauts will return to the moon, which will be really exciting. Part of the reason for these missions is to see if a human habitation could be set up on the moon, not people living there forever, but maybe visiting for vacations, visiting just to explore more about the moon for scientists and engineers.
How advanced is our understanding so far of whether the moon is habitable?
We've got a really good understanding of a very small part of the moon, less than 5% of the lunar surface. And that's the near side, the bit that we see all the time. So we don't know hardly anything at all about the far side. We've got lots of hypotheses, but we don't know for absolute. We've got a good idea that there could be water there, water, ice, and hydrogen. Water you would split into hydrogen and oxygen to make oxygen for breathing. But there's all sorts of interesting experiments about, can you use the lunar soil to make bricks? It's all terribly science fiction, you know.
You mentioned Mars's moons as well. What is exciting about Mars's moon? What does that offer?
Well, Mars has got two moons, one's called Phobos and one's called Deimos. And we don't really know where they come from. There's been no specific spacecraft gone into orbit around Phobos. And we don't know what it's made from. We've got no idea. And the really, really exciting thing for me is bringing some material back, which is what the Japanese are going to do this year. NASA brought material back from Bennu, which was a major highlight for me, having some of this asteroid in the lab to burn. And this is what I'm really hoping in 2029, when the Martian Moon Exploration spacecraft brings back some material. I hope I'm still compartmentalized enough to analyze it. So, I mean, there's all sorts of exciting possibilities because Mars was formed around about the same time as the Earth, a bit after, and its surface has been recycled because it's had water going on the surface, volcanoes, just like the Earth. It's hoped that there might be material from the earliest part of Martian history just left as debris on the surface of Phobos. And it's the same with our moon as well.
I'm interested to know about different countries' missions into space and who is leading what?
There is a global exploration program, which all the space agencies, including Russia and China, have signed up to. No one country really drives the agenda because the questions we're all asking are the same. How did the Earth form? How did the universe form? How did life form? What's the lifetime of a star? These are multinational, cross-disciplinary questions that all scientists in this field want to know the answer for. Space is the place where peace breaks out all over and you rely on each other.
Leila Nathu speaking to Monica Grady, Professor of Planetary and Space Sciences at the Open University. The Austrian government has created a scheme that's designed to encourage people to get things fixed rather than throw them away. They are providing a voucher worth up to 200 euros to get an electrical device repaired. Our correspondent Bethany Bell in Vienna has been finding out how it's working.
Eric's laptop is broken, so he's come to the Helferlein workshop. Because of Austria's repair voucher scheme, he'll only have to pay 50% of the costs to get it fixed.
Yeah, at the moment it's a laptop and I try to make it go again instead of buying a new one.
And this way things can be saved.
Exactly.
Helferlein CEO Clement Schmidt-Gruber says the repair bonus scheme has been great for his business.
Our revenues have doubled since it was introduced, so we are very happy about it. I think the reparatur bonus is a real win-win situation for customers, for local businesses, and of course for the environment. There's less electronic waste.
So tell me how it works. I have a broken computer. What happens?
You come to our repair shop. Either you already downloaded the reparatur bonus on a public website, or we help you do that. Then you hand over your device, we repair it, and in the end you pay the amount of the invoice and you get back half of the cost after 3 to 4 weeks.
The government's repair voucher system is just for electrical appliances. But the city of Vienna runs a separate scheme, which helps people pay for repairs to old clothes, bicycles or furniture. Markus Pieringer, the coordinator of the repair network in Vienna, says it's all about changing policies and mindsets.
The financial aspect of repair is a very important part. The products have to be repairable. So we work on this on the level of the European Union. For many people, it's still very positive to have always the newest product and to throw away your clothing after half a year or even less. We need awareness raising. And actually, we see now in Austria, we have a problem that we don't have enough repairers. So we need a system which is promoting repair as a job. We are working on this at the moment.
Markus Pieringer ending that report by Bethany Bell. Many people say 2023 has been the year artificial intelligence really took off. AI is now everywhere. In industries, education, and even the arts and entertainment. Musicians, actors, and politicians have all had their voices cloned by AI, with or without their consent, and sometimes even when they're dead. And that's led to big questions about copyright, cybersecurity, and fraud. Julian Marshall is the longest-serving NewsHour presenter on the BBC World Service. Could AI possibly pretend to be him? Professor Oliver Buckley from the University of East Anglia has generated a fake Julian, which he presented to the real Julian. And this is what happened.
You need access to someone's voice. As you are a presenter, there is lots of your voice in the public domain. So we take around 5 minutes of audio, upload it to a cloud service, and it creates a model, which is a template for the way that you speak. And then you type something in a box, and that's it. Away you go. It's text-to-speech, and it will spit it out in your voice.
OK, let's cut to the quick. I've never actually heard this before. Okay. Hello, AI Julian, can you hear me?
Hello, real Julian. I'm AI Julian. How are you today? I'm here to steal your job. Do you have any tips that could help me improve my presenting skills?
That's pretty good. My immediate reaction is the sound is a lot thinner. You've certainly got all the cadences. Let's try again. You have a NewsHour script. Let's hear it.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming to you live from London, I'm Julian Marshall. Today in Gaza, more intense fighting with street battles in the south and more bombing in Gaza City in the north. And is Nikki Haley gathering enough support among Republicans to beat Donald Trump in the primaries?
You've given me a little bit of an accent.
Yeah, that does happen actually sometimes. So the way that these things work, your sample of data that we've uploaded of your voice, but also stuff that it knows about voices and how we talk and cadence and pronunciation. So it tends to veer a little bit towards American sometimes, or an American interpretation of British, which ends up being a little Australian. But it does quite a nice approximation with very little effort or input, I think.
What about the ways in which this technology could be abused? This is a scam call in my voice.
Hi, it's Julian here. I'm having some problems with online banking. Can you quickly send £100 to the plumber, please? I'll send you his bank details.
Yeah, a pretty convincing approximation. In an emergency, I can imagine somebody doing what I've requested them to do. And presumably, the technology is becoming more and more convincing.
Yes, so if you look online, there are scores of web-based platforms that you can upload audio to and it will create a clone of your voice or the voice that you give it. The one that I use to create your voice is around £5 a month. There's professional level stuff for the website, so it's aimed at replacing voice actors and getting people to do re-recordings of lines and things like that.
How do you protect yourself against this? How do governments protect their citizens against this?
The problem is the technology has exploded so rapidly. So if we think about ChatGPT, it was a nice novelty and a toy to play with at the start of the year. And now it produces very realistic writing and anything that you ask it to, really. Things have moved that quickly in the last 12 months. It's very hard for legislation to necessarily keep up with that. So that's a real problem. The key thing that people can do is to be objective and be critical. So if you receive a call from someone that seems out of the blue and unusual, then even if it's alarming and stressful, it's important to step back and think if that would actually happen and think about what they're saying.
And this is just voice replication. If AI were to try to steal my job, it would have to be programmed in order to be able to generate an introduction.
Yes, I think for now the AI is only as good as the prompts that we give it. So you could use ChatGPT or Bard or one of the other generative writing tools, and you could feed it a sample of your articles and introductions and say, write me another one in the style of this.
Right.
And then feed it into the voice software, and you could have quite a nice pipeline of content, but it's going to miss that creativity of what we're good at.
Whew. Thank goodness for that.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you, Professor. And perhaps time to say goodbye to AI Julian. Goodbye, AI Julian.
Goodbye, real Julian. Have a happy new year. I'm sure we will talk again soon.
Julian Marshall in conversation with his voice doppelganger, AI Julian. And I think I know which one I prefer. And that's all from the real me for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. And as we head towards the new year, we want to hear about stories which are important to you that we can maybe feature on the podcast in 2024. If you have something you think others will be interested in and the BBC could possibly report on, then send us an email with the details. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and you can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Lovelock, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nigel Adderley. Until next time, goodbye.